First of all, I just want to say I'm really enjoying this set of presentations. I think some really interesting cross-cutting themes, and I'm pleased to be able to share some of the work we're doing also, because I think that's going to continue. There's some issues here that that I'd like to talk about that I think we've already sort of heard a little bit about before. I am with a program at UCLA, and I want to present some findings today from a work in progress that I've been involved with, working with a graduate student at UCLA, a former graduate student who's actually now graduated. And we've gotten some funding to do this data analysis through the California Department of Industrial Relations, and specifically the Commission on Health and Safety and Workers' Compensation. Let's see, so no relationships to disclose. As some of you might be aware, in 2006, there was an innovative study done by researchers in New York City, Los Angeles, and Chicago related to labor law violations in the low-wage labor market in those three cities. The study was conducted with about 4,400 workers in low-wage jobs, everything from service work, small manufacturing, construction, janitorial, hotel services, warehouses. And the sample was recruited across those three cities, so New York, LA, Chicago. The goal of that study was to develop population-level prevalence estimates for violations of labor laws in each of those cities. And one of the things that made this study particularly innovative was that the study team developed, or they used, an innovative sampling strategy known as respondent-driven sampling, which, in short, it's a type of snowball sampling, but there's additional data that's gathered so that after the fact, the data can be weighted in such a way as to arrive at prevalence estimates, prevalence numbers. So it's a strategy that's often used for harder-to-reach populations, to be able to then go back and create more robust statistical findings. So the study team produced four reports. The one on the left here is the national report. Each of the participating cities produced their own city-specific reports. And a lot of the findings here have been really influential in shaping, in the last few years, these sort of broader conversations around wage theft, and really been sort of influential sets of numbers. I should say, in terms of the violations that were particularly highlighted here, we're talking about people who were denied minimum wage in the job, who were not given overtime pay, folks who were forced to work off the clock, meal, rest breaks. So a lot of sort of nuts and bolts wage and hour issues. Among the data that was gathered, however, there was also questions about workers' comp violations. So the study team was interested in looking at what proportion of participants had experienced a workers' compensation violation as well. So here you can see the numbers that the original study teams had published in their reports. What they did is they asked everyone, of these 4,400 adults, they asked them, in the last 3 years, have you experienced an on-the-job injury that required medical attention, whether or not you received that medical attention? And here are the numbers you can see that the teams reported. So across the three cities, about 12% of those reported that they had experienced some sort of injury in the last 3 years. Only 8% of those ended up filing workers' compensation claims in their home states. The study team asked a whole series of questions about the context of that injury to come up with a prevalence estimate of experience of workers' comp violations. And you see at the national level across the three cities, they estimate about 50% of workers who were injured on the job experienced some sort of workers' comp violation in their workplace. And then you can see here the percentage who sought medical care or for whom workers' comp paid their insurance bills. This was the starting point for our research because we went back to that data set. I went back to that data set, and it turns out in order to arrive at these numbers, the original study team had asked a whole series of detailed questions of each of these injured workers about, did you tell your employer, why or why not, how did your employer respond, did you seek medical care, did you submit a form to your workers' compensation program, and those rich details were never reported in these original studies. So from our perspective, I thought it would be valuable to go back in and do some analysis with that level of information to get a better sense of the broader injury experiences that low-wage workers tend to face when they do experience injuries in the workplace. So just by way, kind of briefly, of some background, we know that work-related injuries and illnesses for low-wage workers are undercounted in current surveillance systems. That's not a surprise to anyone in the room. A number of researchers and worker advocates have pointed to things like fear of disciplinary actions, stigmatization, harassment on the job, denial of overtime or promotions, threats of job loss or deportation as significant factors in driving why low-wage workers might not step forward if they have an injury or what they might experience when they do. And, you know, Azaroff and others have pointed to this as a what they call a sort of a conceptual filter in contributing to this underreporting. And then we know that these issues are also connected to sort of the wider deteriorations in standards in the low-wage labor market that we've been hearing about this morning. In terms of looking at injury experiences of low-wage workers, it's what we might consider sort of an invisible workforce in a lot of different ways. It's difficult to document the actual experiences of workers. There have been research studies that have looked at some low-wage work experiences, either their perceptions of vulnerability if they were to be injured or what happens when they're injured. But a lot of those studies, and that includes the work we heard this morning from Syracuse, but a lot of those studies rely on smaller samples within particular industries or smaller geographic areas. So this study, I think, provided a valuable opportunity to look at these kinds of questions, but across a much broader sample size, across industries, across cities, and to tell us a little bit about, you know, sort of what's going on in this labor sector. So the questions that were really driving our work: what worker and job characteristics seem to be associated with work-related injury among low-wage workers? What are the common injury experiences of those workers? And then looking at common pathways and barriers to access to workers' compensation in each of those three cities. And, you know, let me go back for one quick second. I want to point out here, if you look for Los Angeles, this number of workers who experience workers' comp violations in Los Angeles is incredibly high. We are in LA, after all, and so this number really jumped out at us. So another subsidiary question we had was to what extent that has to do with differences in workers' comp law in California versus the actual experiences that workers are having on the ground in that city. So I'll talk a little bit about that also. So we've done the reanalysis of the data from this 2008 study. My grad student and I have been using R statistical software, and given the sampling strategy that have been done, we've been using, in order to arrive at, for some of these numbers, we've tried to move towards population prevalence estimates, and so we've used these bootstrapping methods to generate those estimates when appropriate. So let me quickly present this. This is sort of an initial finding. We wanted to understand what characteristics were associated with injury in this sample. So we divided up the sample. We looked at the 14% of respondents who had indicated they were injured on the job in the last year. That's about 612 individuals. And we pulled them out and we compared their characteristics to the characteristics of the remainder of those 4,400 who hadn't reported an injury or told the survey, the questionnaire person, that there was not an injury. And here's what came up. So we find more likely reporting of injuries in this survey among men, among Spanish speakers, undocumented immigrants. Those working in construction jumped out as more likely to be injured. And then those who were in some sort of short-term, temporary, or day labor role. So this is a little bit of a catch-all category, but there did seem to be some relationship there. The other interesting finding here, and I'm wrestling a little bit right now to figure out even what to do with this or how to talk about it, but it does seem to be one of the questions that was asked in the survey was whether the person had received health and safety training when they got their job. And there was a statistically significant difference between those who did and those who didn't. So those who had received training in their job reported fewer injuries than those who had not. I'll come back to this at the very end, and maybe we can talk about it a little bit. So a little bit of descriptive information about what the survey findings showed. And I should back up for one second. Unfortunately, the survey, the team never asked any details about what the nature of the injuries were. I think from our perspective as occupational health professionals, that's a considerable oversight. We don't really know much about what is actually happening to people in the workplace, but we do know that they, in some form, they're being injured where they need medical attention. So that serves as a kind of baseline for the seriousness, you might say, of these injuries. So you see here about two-thirds told the survey takers that they had experienced one injury in the last 3 years, but a good third of this population had experienced two or more injuries. And we did this cross-cut of data just to understand a little bit more about, in part, maybe the severity, but also the kinds of actions people are taking. So if you look sort of at the third line here, nearly half of folks in this survey missed work and sought medical attention as a result of that most recent injury that they told the survey takers about. But a good quarter of folks here had injuries that at least they said were required medical attention, but they neither missed work nor received that medical attention. It's a fairly significant proportion. Okay, so did workers tell their employer or not? Why or why not? So you see here we have about 11% of the respondents, and now we're just looking at the subsample here of folks who had said they were injured on the job. So this is 613 folks. 11% indicated that they did not notify their employer, and for those folks, they were then subsequently asked, well, if you didn't, why not? What prevented you from telling your employer? Largest percentage said the injury was not serious. Not quite sure what to do with that one, but I think a third say they're afraid of losing their job. 28% say they didn't want to miss work. We've heard this theme come up in previous presentations before. This is clearly a driving factor for people. People are terrified of losing their work, even if they're injured, even if they maybe can't work. That fear of missing work or losing work is very real for people. It's interesting, employer make threats before is a very low number. People were actually asked whether they had been retaliated against or had heard of other workers being, others were retaliated against before. It's a very low number also. For what it's worth, that stuck out to me also that those numbers were a little bit lower than I might have expected to see. These were categories that the survey team had developed and set up in advance, and I think these were open-ended questions that the interviewers in turn then categorized into these categories. So if the employer knew about the injury, how did the employer react? So here you see the raw responses to these questions. So, my grad student and I did this division between what we're calling positive or neutral reactions versus negative or illegal reactions. And we could probably debate a little bit about whether these are appropriate categories. But for simplification purposes, about 11, almost 12%, said that their workers did provide them with a workers' compensation form, or that the employer assisted them in some other way, provided time off, provided first aid, or other forms of support, medical care. Then you get down to the list of illegal reactions, or negative reactions. So 40% indicated that their employer made them work in spite of that injury. Another 32% said their employer refused to help and blamed someone else for that injury. 13% said that they were fired following that injury. I think providing an interesting window and a sad window into the kinds of climates that a lot of these folks work in. And then very quickly here, so in terms of about 10-11% ultimately filed workers' comp as a result of their injury, and then of those who filed, 80% received that claim. That claim came back. So once the filing was done, it did not seem to be a problem in most cases to get that workers' compensation claim accepted. So the next thing we did is we looked at this in terms of kind of a process. So wanting to walk through what are the different stages that an injured worker would have to go through in order to get to the point where they receive workers' compensation. And we wanted to see at what points did people tend to be falling out of this pathway. So this chart, we can read it from top to bottom. Each of the rows we can sort of indicates one step along that process in a sense. The blue bars, maybe we could say, indicate the more ideal pathways or the positive outcome along each of those steps of the pathway. And what jumps out here for me, I think, is that one of the biggest indicators here in terms of where people are dropping out of this whole pathway is a result of the employer reaction. You see more than half of the folks here experience some sort of negative or illegal reaction without some form of negative reaction, regardless of whether they receive something positive. We sort of figured maybe an employer will have a positive response, but also, you know, threaten you with job loss. For the purposes of this, we're actually indicating that as a negative outcome, a negative response, because we feel that would likely trump whatever positive thing an employer is doing. So more than half of the folks here are dropping out as a result of the employer reaction. Very few received a form, workers' compensation form, from their employer. But those who do, as we can see again, many were accepted. Let me just say, one other thing I forgot to say before was that in terms of that question of Los Angeles, what's happening in LA, when we compared the findings of employer reactions in LA versus Chicago and New York, there seemed to be very little difference. So really indicating that what is happening in California, and we can talk about this afterwards if people are interested, but the laws in California around workers' comp are different than in New York and Illinois, and that really is what's driving that higher number. Employers are not necessarily acting any better or worse there. So I was very looking forward to walking line by line here through odd ratios and confidence intervals, but it is Wednesday afternoon and I'm going to give you guys a little bit of a break. So here, just quickly, again, thinking about that pathway model, doing some analysis looking at who's more likely to or less likely to kind of experience each of these. I think the striking thing clearly is that there's this cluster here among immigrant workers, undocumented workers, Spanish speakers, Latinos, who were much less likely to seek medical attention in the face of an injury, much more likely to experience some sort of negative reaction from their employer, less likely to receive a workers' comp form, less likely to file. So I think clearly here we see a pattern where immigrant workers are considerably more vulnerable than others, even within this vulnerable workforce, because we're still talking about low-wage work. And then again, back to our friend health and safety training, curiously we see folks who indicated they had received safe training on the job more likely to seek medical attention, more likely to tell their employer, and then less likely to experience a negative reaction, more likely to receive a form, file a workers' comp claim. Again, what's happening there, I think we're still kind of grappling with how to interpret those results, but I think there's something really intriguing about that pattern, because it's clearly a pattern. So I hear the bell, so I think that indicates that Celeste is about to come up and ring the gong. But, I will just say what's been interesting about this study is that because we're working with this larger data set that's really focused on worker vulnerability in a broader sense, I'm excited to have these numbers and to be able to frame them in a context and sort of, understanding, which I think a lot of us know, but to be able to say, look, when workers are injured, they experience vulnerabilities in all these different ways, and they're not disconnected from all these other forms of vulnerability that we know are out there. Not trying to sort of keep injury issues within a box, but really seeing it in a broader context. So thanks very much.